Hello and welcome to the Pink Bike Podcast. My name is Henry and this week I am joined by Kaz, Dario and Alicia for the pre-news ramble. So Kaz, sometimes there's weeks that are just unbelievably busy with mountain bike technology. This could well be one of those weeks. Why is it this week? Are they trying to get it in before Ciata? Is there some reason or is it just pure coincidence?
I think that is one of the big reasons because we have Ciata coming up next week. So everyone's trying to get it in ahead of time. And then we also have kind of product launches that were backed up from some of these bikes were probably supposed to have been launched last summer, I'd imagine, based on some of the parts and things they're showing up on them. And they just got delayed for various reasons. So all these factors came in. And that means this week there's like five bikes launching a day, basically.
Okay. So what would those, treat me like the idiot I am.
Yes.
What would those reasons be?
The reasons that they got delayed.
So if you had a bike ready that was good to go, built up, sat in a warehouse, why wouldn't you sell it for a year if that was the case?
Because the other half of your warehouse is full of bikes that were from the previous year that you want to sell. I think some of that happened. Yeah, I mean, I think so. And then even product delays are still, like the supply chain stuff that was caused by the pandemic is sorting itself out, but there's still things that were hard to get for a bit. And it's just everything I kind of, mixed up and jumbled. So it's sorting itself out, but it's still taking time.
It's a bit like when you've got fresh food decaying, but you've also got leftovers to eat. You're like, oh, which one do I go for? What's the lesser of the evils?
Yeah, exactly.
Dario, you are a California boy. I believe.
That's right, baby.
That was Katy Perry's original title, and she was singing just about you before the media executives made her rehash it. Are you excited for Ciata? And should people still care about Ciata?
I perhaps amongst media people, am one of the minority cases that really likes Ciata. I think the like frenetic energy suits me well, and it's kind of nostalgic because I would go a lot in college. I think it's always fun. I love free stickers. There's plenty of those at Ciata. It's cool to see everything in one place too. Like, I like the tactile nature of being like, this is this version of a thing and this is the other. I think it's relevant insofar as like, it's where a ton of stuff gets launched, and that's still the case, like this year, apropos of what you were saying about this coming week or the week when this is released, like there's a ton of stuff coming out. It will be the same for Ciata.
I think during the dizzy days of the pandemic where we were stumbling into a new utopia, where it was like, everyone's going to work from home and drive flying cars and no one actually wants to speak to each other. And actually it turns out that a bit of human interaction, it's a balance, but a bit of human interaction ain't too bad.
It feels like you get like 9,000 emails worth of conversations done in 4 days. It's just nice to like talk to people.
Yeah, no, it's really nice. It's really, really nice.
I think maybe in a racing capacity, it's less relevant now. I was talking to some friends who, do a lot of domestic racing, and it sounds like very few of them are going to Ciata for that.
I think it's probably pretty, it's not, maybe not for the racing, maybe more of a trade show nowadays. Alicia, this week we've had the State of the Sports survey trickle out. Thank you for doing so much hard work on it. And thank you, and I mean this sincerely, for not involving me. It's been great. What have some of the challenges been this year? And as we start to get in these results, are there any real big departures that we feel that the sport is changing? Is there anything that you've come across in the articles that you put out? Maybe signs for some sort of encouragement?
Yeah, it's been really interesting working on this year. I was not part of it last year and was only sort of part of it the first year. So I can't say I know everything there is to ever know about the State of the Sport survey. But it is, I think, really cool just to have a window into what the top athletes say about the sport that they do that we don't really hear very often. So just giving them the space to give honest feedback and compare it year to year is, I think pretty cool. It's been interesting tracking the changes between 2021, 2023, and now. I thought it was surprising that athletes are actually getting paid more and have been kind of on an upward trend with that for each year that we've done it, despite the industry kind of taking a nosedive and things being extremely chaotic after the pandemic. I think part of that is due to, the standard pattern of people getting established in their career, like usually people make more money over time when they do something. But also the pool of athletes we're asking is staying relatively the same. Like, we have new people coming in. The age demographics aren't getting super old. We're asking roughly the same top riders all the time who shouldn't on average be getting paid more unless the industry is actually kind of improving for the athletes, I think.
When we did the first one and the results were so low and everyone got paid such meager wages, I didn't know if with that information it would drive wages getting pushed down, because people would be like, listen, that guy gets nothing and you're asking for this? Whew. I was like, oh no, what have we done? Like, we've just broken professional mountain biking.
Well, that is the flip side. In some ways, that is kind of our hope for this entire survey. Like, we want riders to have a lot more information about their value compared to their peers. And we want companies to understand what other companies are doing, what riders get paid, what's kind of expected and standard, just because we think more communication about this whole issue can mostly only lead to improvement in the industry. So it's, yeah, kind of funny to hear that flip side of that too.
I saw this year we're also doing this sort of audience survey. And again, it'll be published, you know, in full, yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's just I don't know, if you're interested in mountain biking, I think it's interesting to think of who rides these bikes, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think there'd ever be a place for an industry survey and mainly just about cable tourism? And how do you think they'd fare?
I think it'd be really interesting. Yeah, I mean, for one thing, the audience survey is, I think, fascinating, because we'll get to see how viewer points of view kind of line up with the athlete points of view and see where the perspectives are different. Because, yeah, I think there's a lot of commonality, but there are also a lot of ways that these people experiencing the same thing, more or less, you know, experiencing the same sport, experiencing the same races, can see it in entirely different ways. And I just think having that comparison will be really cool. The industry, I think, will be fascinating if that ever becomes part of the survey, because riders and industry leaders don't really have the same interests, where riders mostly want to make it sustainable to ride their bikes indefinitely. And the people in charge of companies essentially want to advertise and sell things. And they've figured out how to kind of align those interests so that, I mean, everyone benefits. Like, the riders get sponsored to go to races and do this thing that's incredible, and the companies get advertisement for it, but they're not motivated by the same thing. And I think that always leads to a disconnect. So I would be very curious about what we'd learn from that.
Yeah, totally. I'm surprised we haven't seen more brands in recent years, you know, when you talk about sort of clarity of purpose, go down sort of what YT's been doing, where they basically, maybe not with Valley Hole, but previously with a lot of their races, they've kind of given them more free rein on parts, because, mm-hmm. you know, for how you can maybe, to be honest, sort of service the big OE, the big original equipment deals, and keep kind of partners happy in that realm. I wonder when that will become a point where that outweighs having teams with a myriad of component sponsors getting pulled in lots of different ways. And it's more like kind of, you turn up, we're your bike sponsor, you choose the fastest bike and now go win a World Cup, as opposed to like mm-hmm. this balancing act of everyone having all these different pools on a team.
It also has a way closer proxy to the consumer experience too.
Yeah.
Doing it that way. It's like, you know, every random mountain biker kind of has that carte blanche as well. Like, you can buy whatever you want for your bike.
Mm-hmm. But you do have to have matching tires and your forks have to match your shock, right? You can't ride without it.
Not me.
It's possible.
Is it possible to ride if your handlebar and stem brand don't match? I don't think it is. Ooh.
I don't think we can answer that, because none of us have ever found out.
Now, speaking of racing, we're going to go into this week's podcast, which is a chat with Boomboxes, Maddie and Romain, or Lettuce as he is known, to talk about this season's race tapes. And we go into some details about the racing, the production, and why and how mountain biking needs potentially sort of archetype, maybe some sort of drama, some excitement, and whether that's doing the sport a service or not. I hope you enjoy it. Hello, and a special welcome to Romain Dompnier. who we also call Lettuce. And welcome back, I suppose.
Thank you.
As well as Maddie Wallinger, who's... So can we explain, just for the listeners at home, you both work for Boombox. Now, Boombox is it's a production company that produces many of the things that many Pinkbike audience members will have seen. Today, we're going to be talking about some of the racing-specific stuff you've done over the last couple of years. And can you both explain your role within that, starting with you, Maddie?
I'm a production manager at Boombox, and that kind of means anything logistical. So whether it be crewing, budgets, schedules, booking flights, travel, all that good stuff, that's kind of where I come in.
And Lettuce?
If you're familiar with kind of the content-making industry, you'll know that a lot of these terms are kind of vague and a little bit flimsy, but I am the producer. But in this case, I'm sort of the repository for a lot of the story and for a lot of the kind of contacts of knowing what might be worth talking about, what might not, and how we're going to do it.
And how does it work when you approach a season? Is it a case of you just try and capture what's there? And I don't know, like, are you looking at certain athletes thinking, listen, this could be, for instance, a really good episode talking about the dynamic between Greg and Jackson? Are you there like, listen, this could be fireworks at some point? Or is it a case of you just film them and then that's what you get and you work with what you've got?
Well, I think in documentary filmmaking in general, you collect a bunch of things and then see what sticks later. What we challenged ourselves to do with race tapes last season and this season is to really have a very firm, very universal kind of lens of here's how we can make a story with a good guy, a bad guy, or bad girl stakes, and something that is immediately identifiable and that doesn't rely on results. So I think like one of the better examples of this is in our episode called Home Run. The whole thing happens on two races. You know, it's not a race, it's not a season recap in any way. And so that's why we really aim for these stories before they happen. And from there we see where they go. But like the Greg and Jackson, like there needs to be a, okay, these people are of different age, so what? Like we need to answer that question before we start filming for sure.
I mean, Jeopardy does drive storytelling, but do we need good and bad guys?
I think we do for what we're trying to say. But, you know, like we're not letting the truth get too much in the way of these good stories.
Yeah.
You were at a like friends and family viewing last week. Well, what did you think of it first?
I thought, so we watched two episodes. We watched the Jackson and the Jackson Greg one, and we watched one about Finn. I thought both the production and storytelling was very good. I thought it was the Finn episode, honestly, I thought it was very harsh. If that was someone, so I work, you know, in the video department, if that had been about Cathro or a racer, I wouldn't have let it out. I thought it was really, really harsh.
So that's, I think we're getting to exactly what the difference is between this show and a lot of what's coming out
in the mountain bike industry. It feels like it plays an archetype.
It does.
But Finn's a really good mountain biker. Is it his responsibility to flesh out an archetype of...
No, but it's not a show that's made for him. We always describe this show as the drive to survive, you know, evolved in some ways, but of mountain biking. Drive to survive is not made to placate to the drivers.
No, absolutely. And Formula One's in ruder health because of it. You know, I mean, it's grown the audience exponentially. But when I was watching that, I felt for Finn. I mean, I'm an empath, big softy, but I was watching it, I was thinking, basically the logic, so a very, without, you know, any spoilers, it was talking about Finn as developing as a rider, as well as the combination of enormous talent and also ego. And I am not a talented person and no one's ever thought I was very special, but at 19 years old, I was unbearable. And they didn't even give me the Red Bull helmet. I did it off just purely instinct, you know? And I thought it was, and it was very good. It was compelling to watch, but that's my honest opinion. But what do you think, Mads?
I think it kind of makes you root for Finn and you just want to see him continue to grow and progress in the sport. I think it is really quite interesting because we're really just showing kind of the behind the scenes and the truth of what went on this season. We don't really control the results, but I think it's interesting watching it as a viewer. It was definitely interesting watching it with Finn watching it for the first time. So yes, watching his reactions was probably quite harsh for you in the room or anyone in the room.
I think that's very fair. I think that my senses were probably very much heightened by the fact. And also, again, I also have a different set of experiences than a normal viewer because I am someone that's on the internet. And it's weird because watching the Iron Sharpens Iron felt fantastic because it felt like a lot of insight to something everyone's always been curious about. And I don't know. I mean, I don't, you know, we're talking about this straight away, so I don't want to shit on it because it's an amazing series, but I thought that was pretty keen, to be honest with you.
No, I think this is great because it really gets to the difference of the show and like how I think this show can be received by someone who doesn't know anything about mountain bike racing.
Yes, true.
There's an incentive for people in the mountain bike industry to be doing things that are positive for teams, positive for riders, because that's how you get more work and that's how you get more access. And I think one of the real like unique propositions of Boombox is that we're not the in crowd at anything we do.
Right. Yes. That's
like
that's
I go to World Cups and no one really knows who I am. And arguably we're making, you know, the biggest show there.
And maybe it's better for it. The idea of outside art is you're not, because you know, I think that probably touches upon in mountain biking. I think that's one of the reasons that maybe we have a lack of punditry is because not many people, like, you know, you watch, say, other high level sports and other professionals will be very happy to criticize the people on the pitch that day. And they say, if they'd done this, they'd have done that. Was a bit in mountain biking. I'm not going to fucking get on a podcast and say, well, the thing about Greg Minnaar is you can see if you just waited just his outside a bit more in this turn. Like, so we have, there's this very sort of unclear. And yeah, you're probably right. You know, coming from the outside, it does give you a slightly removed aspect. Let's not, I don't want to get too focused on that because I think it would do a real disservice to the series as a whole. Archetype is super interesting and the idea of how to drive story. Maddie, what was your favorite episode to watch, do you think?
Ooh, good question. Probably Bros Before Foes, which I know that this isn't out yet or it's just come out, but Loic and Loris, seeing them like really diving into kind of their history and their parents' history, how they really grew up together, is quite fascinating. And just to see them be on obviously different teams and different pits, yet still having that friendship and camaraderie throughout the season and throughout their whole lives is pretty special. And it's cool to see it all come to life.
It was very touching. It made me feel quite a bit for Loris.
Absolutely.
As I'm sure was the, you know, it was very well put together. And I know in a sport that thrives on individualism, it must be quite tricky. Were any of you, I'm sure, you know, as you can tell by the credits, a huge amount went into this series. Were you guys on site interviewing them?
I did most of the interviews until I left to get married for MSA and Snowshoe. So I guess the closest I get to the front of the lens is I operate the puppet because there is a puppet in
the
show.
There is a puppet.
Yeah. Funny story about that. I actually, first time we kind of gave life to the puppet, it was more like luck of the draw, like, oh, well, who doesn't know how to use a camera? Lettuce. Okay, so I guess you're doing the puppet. And so we're doing it, and then they're like, you know, maybe we could put you in a green suit because, like, you're going to be, you know. And so I get full green suit, and I'm kind of like, I'm not the leanest boy around, you know, so there's a bit of, like, some sausaging happening. And I'm in this just green spandex suit, and I'm looking at the monitor, and, like, operating a hand puppet, none of my body is in frame at all. So they've just entirely dressed me up in green. So, yeah, that's kind of where we land as far as on site what we're doing.
But you're leaving out the best part about the puppet shoot, because we actually took that photo and added it to our website under Lettuce's team photo. And I think that really speaks to kind of the culture of Boombox, but we're always poking fun at each other. So it's great to know that we have someone gullible on our team.
That's generally the comic relief is really my main job description.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an important role. When you were interviewing these riders, how to put this, Did you get a feel for the honesty at the time? Or do you think it's, as you string it together afterwards, it kind of paints a broader picture?
Both.
So some of the candid approaches is there to be seen. I think it's really wonderful.
Yeah, I think we were lucky this year in that a lot of the athletes were in a phase of their season or their career that they really told us some things that I don't know if they've said a lot elsewhere. Rachel Atherton has kind of like a realization that comes out in the show that I don't think people are expecting. But I think people also have come to trust us to a certain degree. And, you know, we have this big, awkward yellow set that takes 4 hours to build. And I think when people enter that room, and we've really kind of prepared it for them, we don't just show up at the pits and go, hey, do you have 20 minutes? I need to, you know, essentially tax your time in performance mode to do this thing. We really try to give them a space where they know that we're trying to tell a story that is going to be beneficial to them to some degree, and that they can, you know, play along with that. And so I think we've been fortunate to get good things out of them.
I had a very, very brief cameo last year, and I'm someone that I'm normally reasonably comfortable on camera. And I was comfortable, but I did feel, because it was so prepared, I did feel like it was taking the stand in a way that I don't normally get, in a really good way. Mm-hmm. It felt like, you know, obviously every time you go on video, you kind of, you are going on record in a way, but it felt like this was like that, but to an extreme, this is the most on record you could go. And I thought that was a really good, I think it was just this idea of, like you said, stepping into a deliberate and present space just takes over this other part of your brain, like sort of stand up and come forward with it. I mean, some of the candor I thought was amazing. Again, we touched on it before, but for the XC fans, I think I think sometimes the high drama of downhill, which is maybe lends itself more to the show, like the showpiece of mountain biking, but some of the interplay in XC is obviously just as interesting. And they go just as hard, and they risk so much. I thought the openness Matthias Flückinger and Nino Schurter had was fascinating.
Absolutely. And honestly, I had never really seen XC racing in person before until this season and going to Snowshoe. And I was absolutely blown away. Like, I think every single person should try to see an XC race if they can, because they go way faster than you would ever think. And I think it's one of the most underestimated, most underestimated sports, like, or disciplines within the biking world, because a lot of people just kind of brush it off. But sorry, what was the question?
Well, just talking to the incredible rivalry you do see in XC, and I think you're totally right. I think as a spectator as well, XC feels real. I think it's a circuit. You see, you can stand up in the pissing rain and you see Loic Bruni go past in a blur once, or you're in this cauldron looped in, you know, connected by a course. XC racing is one hell of an experience. When it comes to what, I suppose, in this instance, I suppose your client wants Red Bull, do they want a series that covers downhill and has a bit of XC? Because XC's got a bigger audience, or do they want to bring the XC audience to the downhill, do you think?
I think more the latter, and vice versa. You know, I think we're in North America where gravity is
cool. Super cool.
Yeah.
Fucking cool, bro.
I think cross country is, if you're in Switzerland, you know, it's probably the only, if you say mountain biking, that's what it is, right? And then you've got these juggernaut kind of bigger than life characters that are from this place. So I think that's kind of an easy to identify good story. But I know that Red Bull wants kind of equal kind of attention on both, so long as the story is worth it. You know, I they're not trying to tick boxes particularly.
And as someone, you know, you're saying you're attending your first XC sort of race weekend, coming back from that, if you had to recommend a weekend of watching downhill or XC, what do you think is the better spectator proposition?
Ooh, good question. I'd say try to go to a World Cup where there's both, actually.
Yeah, no, very true. But if you could,
But
we're talking about, you know,
I guess from a spectator perspective and whether you bike or not, I think that XC would be quite captivating just to be in the field because you really get that rush of, wow, this is way bigger than I maybe anticipated. Whereas downhill, it is really exciting because you get to see the steepness of the terrain, but you may only see, you know, one tiny section of that whole race run, depending on where you're standing, or you might be looking at a screen. So I think XC could be a little bit more thrilling because you get to see a lot more part of the track.
Last year when we spoke of sometimes the difficulties of covering something like downhill because the face is concealed, you know, which is such a huge thing for buy-in, for the personality to see people do it in the real deal. With the changes that have come in this last year, maybe going to the semi-final, maybe seeing more racing essentially over the course of a weekend, do you think that's helped the average spectator? And has it helped your coverage in a way? Because it feels like, you know, through the semi-finals and stuff, it does, you know, when we're talking about the sharp end of racing, it does sort of, you know, just help kind of track the weekend in a certain direction.
Yeah, I don't think I'm well enough informed to know how much it helped people identify what's happening, like what the story of that race is. I will say that just on a logistics footage side, it's great for us because it's one more race where the whole broadcast, all the ENG cameras are shooting. And so, you know, perhaps you never know through the magic of television that do we splice in a semifinal turn into another moment? Who knows, you know, but that is an advantage on our end for sure. Absolutely. I think it's also just fun to watch another run.
So when I got really into mountain biking and really tried to understand what downhill is, and which is a challenge into itself for the layman, there were things like 3-minute gaps, like first, which would be maybe an hour and 10, hour and 15 long, and it felt like an incredibly in-depth look or recap of a season. But with 6 episodes at 30 minutes, this is actually, you know, two of those great in-depth things. What does it, I mean, it must take a huge amount to get six 30-minute episodes together. Can we talk a bit about like that production flow and what the sort of standard is that Red Bull demanded in the first place?
Yeah, I think both on the Boombox side and on the Red Bull side, the point was to make a show that is meant, like, is not great for mountain biking. It is just a show that you would watch on television.
Right.
Our ambition is to make the show that you tell people who don't know about mountain biking to watch when they go, oh, what's mountain biking about? Or what's mountain bike racing about? You seem so interested in that. This is that show. And so the effort is pretty substantial, but I think it's less than people, like pro rata, it's probably less per minute than what a lot of other things are. It's funny that you would talk about 3-minute gaps because we were lucky
Clay
enough.
Porter was, I saw him in the credit.
Yeah.
How cool is that?
Yeah, so cool. So cool.
What was his role within it?
So he was doing some director of photography and just camera work. Like, you know, I think he was excited to do something slightly different than what he had been doing for the last couple of years. But to a certain degree, it was also like, hey, do some Clay Porter shit. Like, that's rack that focus, you know, like that's a $10,000 shot right there. So it's, it was really cool to have Clay. And also I think Clay has a sense for what's interesting in mountain biking, having been there for so long that I think he's kind of, not blasé about just like excitement, but I think he's able through time to like distill to what we're trying to get to as well. Right. Like we talked about at the beginning, we lose a lot of nuance on purpose. We want the story to be super easy to identify, and Clay Porter helped us do that and also just boost the visual kind of production value of the whole thing.
Was there any storylines? There must have been, you know, you got these 6 episodes. There must have been the 7th storyline that didn't maybe quite make the cut, although I'm sure was very interesting. Was there anything, maybe start with you, Maddie, was there any storylines you identified throughout the season that you wish you could have delved more into?
Oh gosh, I always say with every production, I'm like, we should really just be making a behind the scenes of the crew of what takes to make something like this. In terms of actual storylines, I mean, Lettuce, you could probably speak a little bit better to that, but I have a funny story just in terms of Clay Porter. I mean, yeah, it was so, if no one really knows who Clay Porter is, like, he's this legendary DP that, like, our directors, Jeremy Bouchard and Justin Loisel, grew up absolutely admiring. And it was really funny when I called him up and we got him on board. And then the first time that at least I met him was in Snowshoe. So we land in West Virginia, which is already an interesting place to go. And we were all staying at an Airbnb. So we decided, you know, we should probably just split groceries just to be a little bit healthier, save a little bit more money. And so we rock into this grocery store, we grab a cart, everyone's kind of grabbing different items off the shelves, down different aisles. And we get to the checkout and I notice this huge milk carton size, like family size box of Goldfish. So I'm kind of looking around, like, I don't know who would have grabbed this. That's not the healthiest snack. It's probably not something I would gravitate towards. And so I'm like, surely it's got to be some of the dads on the crew. Turns out it was Clay. So we're not quite sure what to do. We're like, do we say anything? Like, he's this legend, this icon that, like, we're just so excited to work with. And so we kind of go along with it and we split the groceries. And, you know, like, that box of Goldfish is probably $30.
Nice.
And, and we get to our Airbnb, but every day I wake up in the morning, I'm making breakfast and I see this looming box of Goldfish on top of the fridge. I'm like, that's weird. No one's opened it yet. As the week kind of ticks on, we get to our final day of filming and I'm like, hey guys, what do we do about this ridiculous snack? And they're like, yeah, yeah, we got to give Clay a bit of an ultimatum. So I go up to him. I'm like, hey, Clay, if you do not finish this box of Goldfish by the end of the day, we're flying home tomorrow. Like, you absolutely need to pay for this on your own. Like, we're not splitting the bill. And he's like, yeah, 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 it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. Next day, we wake up, everyone's packing up the car, and I just see Clay pop into the passenger seat with this massive box of Goldfish on his lap, not tucked away in his luggage. And he's like, guys, I know I didn't open this, but it's going to be my carry-on. It's going to be my personal carry-on item. And we were like, oh, I guess that's not the snack that smiles back at you today. So yeah, it was quite it was quite interesting to work with Clay and get to know him better. But I think, I mean, we still bug him. I'm like, have you eaten those Goldfish? I was even going to text him today. Well, that's what's going on.
I suppose that's the interesting thing about Clay Porter, because I knew his name and I knew his voice, that sort of narration that he does from that slow cadence, quite deep narration that you would have seen in some of his films. And I didn't put them together. So, and then I knew what this person looked like at World Cups. And then I heard him speak about film and it all just, I was like, that's it. Because this series does without that sort of consistent narration. Was there any temptation to put that in, or was it, how does that work?
There was. So to come back to, like, the genesis of the show, Red Bull says, hey, Fast Life is amazing. It's been going for 5 years, but we want something different. Let's make the opposite of Fast Life. And so hence, you know, the super bright interview set. And, you know, we wanted to not use narration as a crutch, right? Like, the story, you need to be able to know what the story is if you're watching it on your phone and, like, a bus passes by or something. Like, it can't rely on words. And so, yeah, that was one of our big challenges. And to tell you the truth, a year and a half ago, we were watching a cut and, like, oh, do we narrate this? Like, are people gonna understand? And, you know, we ended up not needing to, and I think it's better for it.
And what's it like, was there any onus to, I mean, it just so happens most of the time that the most interesting or high profile athletes are Red Bull athletes. Is there any onus to cover Red Bull athletes more than non-Red Bull athletes? Because there are some episodes, like I said, the Iron Sharpens Iron, the protagonists have nothing to do with Red Bull, at least outwardly. Is it all kind of fair game?
Yeah, if the story is there, like, we can really cover whatever. We really have, like, no specific mandate. But I think that's the beauty about this series, is really what's unfolding and where we can dive deeper and show the viewer kind of the very human side of mountain biking, as opposed to just what you see on a World Cup weekend.
It's funny we talk about, like, it's sounds very, again, flimsy, like the human side and the story and all that. I think we're so much more susceptible to that than we think. Like, the the brands on our bikes, right? Like they're, it's a story. Like what is X brand? You know, we attach all this meaning to it. And I think the racing is really heightened by the story. Like it's not just bike riders going fast and that's.
No, but I understand what you mean. I mean, I think without buy-in, like without the human element, it's hard to have buy-in because they are essentially two-dimensional characters on a screen that you need to flesh out through people's empathy or otherwise into three dimensions. And especially with you wanting to get these people to get what you think they deserve, that's what storytelling is. You know, that's how we make sure people stay interested, I suppose. I mean, for all the sort of highs of World Cup racing, it does seem that it's a really interesting mix because so much of this is done not as fly on the wall. Don't get me wrong, there are some moments where the person is in the pits at the right time to capture the right moment. But it feels more than anything, it's a story of individuals in their own words that has then been supplemented with fly on the wall footage, which must be enormously challenging because you, I don't know, I mean, was it hard? Because you, I imagine trying to coax the right, not the right thing, but try and coax that honesty out of people could be difficult in some ways.
There's really two interview dynamics. And I think you were the recipient of one, which is as, you know,
when you threatened me to say interesting things and you said I was going to beat you up.
Exactly. Yeah.
I remember now. It's all coming back.
Yeah. It's the green suit. I mean, I wear it all the time.
The time that Boombox waterboarded Henry.
Yeah. No, I think you might have felt interrogated because you were being interrogated on a bunch of different things very quickly. There wasn't a ton of link between, you know, it was like, hey, what's your take on this? What's your take on this? And that might be actually kind of manipulating you into saying things that are spicier maybe because it's like rapid fire, right? We do sort of the opposite with athletes who are telling essentially their life story or their year story, which is we really start at the like very basic, hey, where were you? What were you doing? How were you feeling? And it's odd, but people want to tell that story.
Yes.
Once you get them started, it's more about kind of steering them rather than trying to get things out of them.
Well, that's because, you know, in a similar way, that's why I like the podcast thing. But the thing is that you might think this athlete has probably had this on their back for ages and they want to set the record straight. And I've had it where before you've said, so this happened. What did that make you feel? And they've had a bullet in the chamber to say, this was the truth. People think this was the truth, but actually this is how it went down. And you can tell it's weight off their chest. But sometimes they decline. And they just go, that's actually like, basically not, they're not saying it directly, but what essentially is that I've misread the situation because they simply don't really give a fuck. And I've been operating on the assumption they did. And they're just like, yeah, that happened. And that's it. That career defining thing that, like, oh no, it didn't define me at all. Oh, okay.
So it's funny that informs our story throughout the season. You're saying how much of what's lost in a season? What was that seventh story we didn't do? I don't think there's a seventh story, but there's angles to each story. Like there's entire races that we edited and then cut out because we're like, oh, that actually is saying something that's very interesting, but it's not in the direction of the story that we're telling. And so you end up with like Matthias and Nino. At first, when I pre-interviewed them, they're like, oh, that's old news. You know, we don't really need to talk about that. But it's the, we don't really need to talk about that. Or, hey, how about we talk not so much about that? That's like the oh, so that's what we're talking about, right? Mm. People give that away. And so sometimes that doesn't matter, depending on how you say it, could mean, oh, that's actually what we're going to dig into.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly what we're here for. Obviously, these World Cup athletes are enormously stressed. Not stressed, sorry. They're not stressed, but they have a lot of stress placed upon them in terms of the exertion, the mental, the physical toll. Is it hard to kind of chaperone them into a room? Is it hard to eat into their time? And how do you manage that?
Yeah, honestly, it's all about building relationships with them, I think. Now that we have two seasons under our belt, they definitely know us a little bit more. They trust us. And it's nice to just be connected with them over, you know, WhatsApp. But setting up all of those things in advance is the easiest way. And then to be quite honest, we kind of engineer it so that we also really focus on like getting them outside of a race weekend as well and really seeing them in their element. There's less pressure and we really get to see what their home life is like, or, you know, going in their backyard and figuring out like a place to ride or doing other like extracurricular activities. So
when it's, as we spoke to, there's the lack of narration to sort of have that consistent thread of, you know, bodiless authority to run through. But that does mean sometimes, I suppose, you have to sort of create organic situations where they talk about a certain thing.
Absolutely.
How does that work with, because these
They're
people
not actors.
Aren't trained actors or people that maybe even want to have any level of celebrity or notoriety.
Absolutely.
How does that work?
So to get back to your coaxing them into a room, I think the challenge is that they're in a mental state that changes so drastically depending on how they're performing, that they can agree to something and then show up and be a totally different person, which is, it's why they're so good. And so there is kind of like a gamble there of like, oh, okay, like I'm dealing with this version of this athlete. What are we going to do with that? Is this the time that we're going to make them, you know, not trash talk, but like be a bit more
open and unguarded?
Oh, yeah. Or are they going to be more into technical details because that's how they're feeling? When they're at home, they don't have the constraint of competition, but they usually don't really want to talk about the past very much at all. And we might be asking them to replicate something like a conversation that they had 6 months ago. And the results can be a bit awkward at first, but to tell you the truth, like once you start talking to your significant other on camera and there's a three-year-old walking around, after about 6 minutes, you kind of start moving forward and it works out.
Do you think a reluctance to look into the past is a human trait or a trait that is common among elite athletes?
I think it's only an athlete thing.
Is it an only athlete? What yeah. do you attribute that to?
Well, I don't think that they don't look into the past. I think that they don't want to talk about looking
into it. Yeah, totally. You think it's where do you think that stems from? And if it does stem from anything, and this is a theory we're only just fleshing out, but what would it serve? What would be the end goal of not wanting to look or go back into the past?
Maybe just putting too many expectations on themselves, really. Who knows?
I think it might come into why it was so uncomfortable, or not so uncomfortable, but why it's not easy to be in the room with Finn when pundits are talking about his early career, about where the message in all of these shows is positive. It makes you want to go ride your bike. It makes you want to go watch the races. You don't leave any of these episodes going, I really don't like that guy, right? Or that girl. Mm. But the verbalization of it, and I think that's why athletes don't particularly want to talk about the past, or that they will answer in platitudes, is because if you have to think and verbalize, all of a sudden it takes all this mental space. It kind of becomes true. And that's what we're doing in a way, is sort of the record of part of their life story. And so we're verbalizing it, and it might be a bit awkward.
Okay. Well, speaking of looking back into the past,
yeah.
Let's go into the Finn thing. I think we got to a lot of honesty straight away at the initial part of this podcast. And I wasn't quite sure. No, like I said, I really, really respect the work. I thought the series was great, but if someone asks me what I think, I'm sadly just quite a straight down the line person. With the Finn thing, the thing that I thought was difficult for me to watch was not the sort of development or personality that exists around a expert level bike racer. It was the comparison to Puck, and the thing that I thought was a bit of an omission was the fact that he didn't talk about the difference between under 23 to elite compared to junior to elite. He was 18 when he went into elite. And that's a very different story to when Puck went into elite at 24.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the same age.
Mm-hmm.
And he's challenging for overalls now when she's challenging for overalls. And that omission, I thought it was a bit unfair.
I think you're probably very right. I think that's the kind of nuance that explaining is too cumbersome to do.
Yeah, I totally, because mountain biking is just too complicated.
Yeah.
Like, you need to make it simpler. It's so complicated.
Yeah, my wife was watching the home run episode with Valley and Rachel and said, oh, are they on the same team? Because they were wearing the world champs jersey.
Yeah.
Right? And then I had to explain, the world championships, plural, is one event. And the World Cup happens, like, those are things that, the only way we could have added that to the show is by making fun of it, because it's so almost ridiculous, right?
But it's even the sort of the way that we describe it's similar to how mountain biking, you know, clipless is clipped in. is that, but on what? Because World Cup, when people think World Cup and other sports, they think of the one event that's almost like the one day event of the year, you know. But in mountain biking, the World Cup is the series. Maybe arguably say with similar skiing. And then World Champs is confusing. But if you ever watch downhill, like you were saying, with especially on the live feed, with somebody that's never seen it before, they are bewildered. They're like, so who's fastest? Oh, it's this person that we didn't see. Oh, and why how did that happen? Why didn't we see him? Oh, because they did it ages ago, and then the track's changing, and then the commentary is, you know, the commentary is largely pretty good, but it's just really hard to commentate a downhill race, because it's not like Formula One where it's like, you know, things can change so quickly. Setup is really, it's like invisible. So in like, yeah, again, in other sports, it'd be like, he's got the red ring on his tires. He's on the super softs. In mountain biking, it's like, he might have a 27 in the back. He might do, who knows? Or she might be on a cut spike, but really it's impossible to say. And it's so speculative. And I know, I think we spoke about this last year, but there is some bloodied noses in elite downhill. But they're also, I mean, I don't agree with the lack of communication around the changes that are happening. I mean, not that what I think really matters, but they're also, I think some professional downhill, it needs to be sort of simplified, kind of, in my opinion, and shored up.
Mm-hmm.
Because without viewers, you know, which is another story.
That's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, totally. It's really hard to justify.
It is very hard. I think it's applicable to everything, though. Like, we do a lot of projects in different sports. We even do a lot of things in gaming. And I think that's maybe why we enjoy doing a bunch of different things, is because we can go, oh, hey, work with us, because we're not from your world. Here's what we think as outsiders is going to work. But we also have the tools to make it like appealing to whoever you guys really are. And yeah, your frustration is our frustration and our motivation to be like, no, let's make a show where we only explain something if it's absolutely necessary to understand, but you're, you know, involved, like you want to see how this race that we've turned into 10 or 15 seconds pans out.
Mm. And do you think, because in some ways, I suppose you could say that Fast Life, I don't know if this is how you feel or not, but it felt like Fast Life in many ways was in a similar vein to as a precursor to Drive to Survive.
Mm-hmm.
Then Drive to Survive has really set the standard. Now every sport wants their Drive to Survive moment, you know. In some ways, Drive to Survive, for those of, I'm sure we're going to talk about just before we go into too much detail, is the Formula One series that makes the personalities out of the drivers. Basically each sort of team or driver's dynamic gets kind of an episode of the season, and it's all very interesting. There is some Hollywood moments. It's almost meant to be sort of, I think if they did a Drive to Survive that was meant for people that really loved Formula One 5 years ago, it would be terrible. Because me as a Formula One fan that doesn't really like Formula One anymore, because I feel like it's got too entertainment focused. And I'm there like, I want to see people race between pit stops and not one overtake. Thank you very much. But is Drive to Survive like the gold standard, or do you think there are actually some other documentary series around sports that are potentially a bit better?
I think the production company that makes Drive to Survive are the same people behind a lot of these other commissioned documentaries, you know, golf, tennis, that they've done something really amazing, and that they've created this trend of hot sports docs that entertainize these quite technical sports in a way, quite niche interests into, and they've done a great job. I think now it's harder to watch if you're a fan even of those shows, because the formula is being rinsed and repeated quite aggressively. I think the challenge we gave ourselves was to copy the best things of that, but bring it into sort of an internet age, into not taking itself quite as seriously. And I think Drive to Survive has done a good job of, you know, laying off the Hans Zimmer like organ stabs when the red lights are turning off. Mm. But yeah, we're riding bikes. Like, let's make it a lot more fun.
You know? Yeah. And I think that's important, because I think with Drive to Survive, they sometimes make such a caricature of the problem that by the time you get to the problem, you've seen so much hype that you don't know whether to believe the explanation of the problem is valid.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because you're there just like, well, the boy cried wolf like six times already. Mm. I don't know. Yeah. I think it's super interesting. I think it'd be really interesting to see. I know, because I think that with Drive to Survive, to a degree, maybe I think I watched the first three seasons, and I think that there was a degree of the drivers knew what they were dealing with by the third season. And it'd be interesting to see in humble little old mountain biking whether people will, you know, second, third season, they can be like, oh, this is going to be a pretty good off-season weapon.
This is also one of the great parts about World Cup mountain biking. There are a lot of teams. Every year, there are new people coming into juniors, coming into elites, coming into U23. And we don't need to revisit them as much. I think like there's a lot, it'll be interesting to follow some of the stories, but I know for the next season, I don't think we're really revisiting much. It'll be a fresh cast of faces.
Can you guys do me a favor?
Yeah.
Please. Mm-hmm. I want to just follow specifically the internal dynamics and the specialized team.
Internal dynamics.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I think they had this like top dog.
Mm-hmm.
Like if we compare it to other teams, like it felt like they had this quite rigid setup where Loic was a sort of the top dog, Finn was his understudy, and then there was Chris Grice, who kind of got moved on to a more regional setup, and Jordan Williams came in. And even the fact that Jordan didn't have, he had the bike he could buy off the shelf, you know? And the fact that Loic was injured when that new bike came out, so Finn had it before him. And then the start of the season, Jordan winning. And I think they all seem quite different characters, but they all seem like that Jordan Williams. I don't know. I think I said hello to him in passing once, but he seemed to have that kind of intensity. And it was just like, I wonder what this is going to do in the long run, you know?
That's a great run team.
It is a great one team.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive, their setup.
Do you see any common denominators between the great one teams? Because I look at it like, I don't know. When from the outside perspective, without as much access as you have, to me, it's never any wonder that Specialized do well, that Santa Cruz Syndicate do well, that in the past, Gwyn's programs have done well. Not because of the budget, just because of the intense focus.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you pick up on? Are there any teams there that you think sort of share that intense focus, but maybe didn't get the success last year? Just from talking to them, you know?
I think, contrary to what, you know, a broadcaster might do, where they really go through, you know, Elliot Jackson's probably talking to all the teams and kind of getting a feel. We're really kind of in our little space doing our things with our couple of protagonists. I will say that the strong leadership, like on Specialized, Laurent Delorme, like strong leader. And I think that's what we see in a lot of these teams that are, you know, quote unquote, like factory teams, is that racers are part of a hierarchy. It's not like a team built, oh, let's get this guy to the races or get this girl to the races. That seems to be the common thread, at least to me, as far as like keeping in the focus and the intensity.
Mm. When it came to dealing with sort of big characters, team managers trying to organize things, sometimes team managers can kind of be like mother hens, quite protective of their athletes, both in terms of on a personal level, but also just in terms of like who gets any agency or onus upon their schedule. You know, was that quite difficult to manage? Sometimes being like, no, honestly, this is a really good thing for you to be a part of. Fucking come on down. Or is that one pretty open?
I guess, Lettuce, you can probably speak to more of like the original communication. But to be honest, I think they really enjoyed having us there sometimes. Yeah. It depends in the moment, obviously, when emotions are running high for different athletes, depending on how their race runs are going. But I'd say like they typically would welcome us into the pits with open arms.
It was a little bit hard at the beginning to get some of, because a lot of these stories are about a team. They're not just about a racer. And so there's all the kind of commercial implications of that, right? Someone's speaking not as themselves, as just their interests, but as the leader of an organization. That is harder. To their credit, though, like once they established what they were after and what they're willing to do and not to do, Trek Factory Racing is our first episode. I think it's a really strong story. I think they struggled while we were there and maybe had some reservations, but were willing to trust us with that story, which they're, you know, probably the first or second biggest mountain bike manufacturer on earth. Like, that's a pretty high stakes thing for them to do. And so, yeah, they are protective, but I think they can kind of read through, you know, read through the lines or between the lines and see kind of where we're going. But remember, like, no one knows us.
Right. Yeah.
Like we're
it's like
showing
a confession
up.
Box.
Yeah. And it's actually great because I, for instance, don't hold a camera, and it's not like, oh, Lettuce over there doing his little thing. It's kind of like someone wants to come into my pits just to talk to me about something that's going to happen 3 months from now. Like that, I think that's maybe refreshing to them. Mm. Knowing also that it's not going to come out. Like, we tell people straight up, hey, we're going to record something. You're going to forget about it for like 6 months, and then it's going to come out right as you're starting a new season. That's a big deal.
I forgot about my mustache last year. That was a fucking shock. Seeing that thing. Jesus. yeah, I think that's really interesting. But I think it's also really interesting what you said about, you know, the teams and access, and also with Laurent Delhomme, because I think that sometimes within teams, and it's the same with a lot of companies, this is not specific to mountain biking, but there's like, much like in countries, you get the head of state and then you get the head of government. Often teams have the head of state who does the symbolism of what the team is, the culture. And then you get the head of government, who's like the road manager, who just kind of makes sure things get done and things get ordered. And the head of state basically, you know, sort of swears in the staff as to who's what the standard's going to be. But largely they are kind of slightly more, maybe slightly less executive in some things. As we sort of, you know, round this out, where can people watch race tapes this season? And when will it be coming out? Is it dumped in one load? Is it serialized?
It's batch released, so everything comes out April 8th on Red Bull TV. That's going to be, I think, its main home. Mm-hmm. I would recommend you watch it on a large screen television, because it's a TV show. These are not edits. These are not, like, it's worth your time. And I think that's how you should watch it. And hopefully with someone who doesn't know anything about mountain biking, I think that'll be a really fun experience for people to do.
Well, I am available for hire.
So there you go.
I can come sit with you and you can explain it all to me. Sweet. I think that pretty much covers everything. Thank you very much both for your time today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Roman, thank you for coming back after the slight disaster of last year. And yeah, it was great having you on.
Yeah, I hope we actually get you back on the show, maybe if ever you're at a World Cup or one swings by around here.
Holy shit, I'll start growing the facial hair. We'll get it going on. Thanks, guys. And we are back. Now, as you come back to the world of tech mountain biking, the latest tech and the big week of tech, I wanted to actually talk, Dario, very quickly about the new Rocky Mountain. I get so confused with the brand names. This is the Altitude, which is the...
Altitude.
So that's the big bike, right?
Not the biggest bike. The Slayer is the biggest bike. The Altitude is a similarly large race-oriented bike.
I don't know why. They turn my brain to mush. I don't know. I can't work out which one's which.
It's hard to, because like Slayer kind of indicates big serious thing, but altitude, it almost sounds like it might be an XC bike.
I just said it XC.
Assumption. Yeah. The altitude has always been their enduro race bike and continues to be that. They made a concerted effort with this one to make it more racy, I think, like from feedback from some of their racers and from the brand itself. Like that was really the point here. It was like kind of honing in that design towards like high level of racing. Geometry got pushed quite a bit. The last one was a great bike, but maybe aired a bit more towards trail bike numbers in terms of head angle and reach and stack and all that, and was a really good do-it-all bike for that reason. But the new one is definitely more gravity focused. It still has, I'm going through all the numbers in my head. There are too many geometry numbers to even touch on because you can change all of them drastically. It's got the ride four position adjust dealio. You can change the rear wheel size. You can change the reach plus or minus 5 mil from neutral. All to say, you can like really dial in the fit of the bike, which I really like as an approach.
So
it airs on super slack. It's like 63 and change in most head angle orientations.
So it's like pretty a Santa long, Cruz with a bit more geometry adjustment, because that's what it kind of looks like, no?
It looks like a Santa Cruz, yeah. So I guess that's the other, the hot topic on this is they moved away from a four bar layout and it's now like something akin to VPP. They call it LC2R, which stands for something. And it, it is a co-rotating or counter-rotating dual link design. So similar to a Santa Cruz, but this one has a concentric bottom bracket pivot, which is kind of cool.
Well,
and funky, but
I mean, it's good to get out. It's been kind of spotted out and about for a while, and you know, to cleanse our minds of probably pivots and the incoming patent wars that will engulf mountain biking in the coming years. Let's do some music corner. Kaz.
Yeah.
Why is it Beyonce's new album for you?
I actually listened to Beyonce's new album.
Oh, did you? Nice.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah.
As an American, do you find it offensive? Are you the American that finds it offensive or the American that finds it empowering? I forget. It's country music, right?
Yeah, I don't mind. It's fine. It's like a thing. I mean, I think most artists at some point, they do their, like, if you're a pop artist, you do your little, like, country thing just to get some more listens. And I mean, it's fine. It's nothing like groundbreaking, obviously. Jolene's been covered 6 billion times over the years. But, like, I don't know. If it opens more people's minds up to like different kinds of music and stuff, I'm for it. I mean, it's just Beyonce. Not just Beyonce, obviously. Someone will tell me Beyonce. That I'm an idiot for that.
Guys, how dare you?
Yeah.
On this podcast?
That is not my pick, though. Like I said, I listened to it once and probably won't listen to it for a long time now. But no, my pick is a band called Soul Glow that I didn't actually know about, but then they did an NPR Tiny Desk concert recently that was insane. Like, I think it's the first hardcore band to be on Tiny Desk. And it's very cool. Good. Like, you got the feeling that they were going to destroy the office if the show went like a little bit longer. So the band's called Soul Glow, and then their album, it's from their album Diaspora Problems, but the track that I've been into is called Driponomics. Check out Soul Glow. They're pretty cool.
Nice. Alicia, do you have a music corner suggestion?
You know, Kaz already took my Tiny Desk concert thing, so I might have to branch out a little bit.
Well, it's because this time it was a hardcore band on Tiny Desk, so I had to take it.
I'm not branching out too much, though, because a couple of weeks back I recommended a podcast, and I think I'm going to go with that again. I'm going to give a shout out to the podcast Cloud Based Mayhem, which is a paragliding podcast that basically interviews anyone who would be interesting to talk to within the sport. So that's competitors, that's people who think really creatively about their training, people who basically can show the rest of us how to approach a sport in a way that makes sense and makes our lives better. So even if you're not remotely interested in paragliding, it's still worth a listen. I have listened to it a lot, kind of just to try and figure out how interviewing works and how to get better at learning, I guess, what makes people kind of move ahead in their sport. So I don't know. I think it's just really worth a listen and a bunch of interesting conversations. And it's run by a guy named Gavin McClurg, who, since paragliding's tiny, is also a guy I know, and a lot of guests end up being friends of mine, so it is exciting to kind of be proud of people I know who do cool stuff. But even if you don't know anyone who paraglides and don't have any connection to the sport, I'd say it's still worth a listen.
Have they ever done a mid-air interview?
Ooh.
Nice.
I don't think
imagine the wind noise would be challenging, but
Well, no, it's a bit challenging, and you tend to be pretty far apart from each other unless you're tandem.
You do it by walkie-talkies. But,
yeah, exactly. Totally. There could be. There's hope.
Dario, what would your music corner be?
I'm gonna stick to my guns. I got a loud, noisy album for y'all. It's by the band Upchuck, who I have been listening to nonstop all year. Upchuck is great. Upchuck, please come tour on the West Coast. Album is called Bite the Hand That Feeds. First track.
Well, that's just bad advice. I'm sorry. That is bad advice. Don't bite the hand that feeds, kids.
Or the nibble, perhaps.
Or the nibble. Nibble the finger of generosity. Yeah. Nice. Sick. Mine is Stay Ugly by Crimes. If you want to listen to something that is basically Crystal Castles, incredibly derivatively copied, but in quite a nice way, then that'd be that. And you go from there. Thank you very much for listening, as ever, to the Pink Bite Podcast, and we will catch you next time.